Well, Will Fleming and Sean McDonough. Will Fleming and Joe Castiglione certainly earned their pay today with a spring training home debut for the Red Sox that took over 3 hours, 21 total runs, 29 total hits, 3 hours and 7 minutes. But a win is a win is a win. And we welcome you in here on WEEI. Dan Ball with you. Thanks for spending some time here with us as it's just after 4 o'clock, 4:21 to be exact, here on February the 22nd, 2026. The final show here on WEEI this afternoon before the snowpocalypse here in the greater Boston area and beyond. So I echo right off the bat what Will Fleming ended his broadcast with. If you haven't hunkered down by now, make sure you do so very soon, because especially if you're in the southern part of the state, headed towards the Cape and headed down towards the Mansfield area specifically, looks like you're in for quite the next 24 hours. So grab your food, grab your drinks, grab everything you need for a cozy 24 hours. And thanks for spending the beginning of it here with us on WEEI. And you can join the conversation at 617-779-7937. I have you up until 6 o'clock here this afternoon into evening. And right off the bat from the 774, hey, ball game, USA, USA, USA. That is verbatim the text line in our opening text here on our show. Hello to you from the 774, because the United States are gold medalists in men's hockey and women's hockey. Both sides for the first time ever. First gold since 1980 for the men. Just the third time overall. Man, that fires me up. Attaboy, Tristan. Well timed. My man Tristan Andrew back behind the glass here today, riding with me. What a day it's been. Now, if the United States had lost, would I come on here complaining about the start time? Probably. I would spend a lot more time complaining about 3-on-3 overtime in a gold medal game. That's for damn sure. But neither of which matter, because the United States is gold medal winning in men's hockey here in 2026. What an awesome game to cap off what was just a tremendous tournament on the men's side and the women's side in hockey for this year's Olympiad. Tristan, did you watch the game? How much of the game did you catch? Where'd you watch the game this morning?
Well, I will admit, Dan, I kind of was late to bed last night, so okay. Unfortunately, I missed the beginning of it, but I woke up just in time for overtime,
okay.
And I got to experience that about as live as my DVR would let me.
Okay, you know what? I like that. As long as you saw some of it, that's fine. And I mean, you missed.
It was one of the great hockey games ever played, if you ask me.
Absolutely, 100%. And Connor Hellebuck turned in what was one of the greatest goaltending performances of all time. He set the American NHL goaltender record for saves in an Olympic game, I believe, is the number that he set today. I'll go and double check that, because we'll talk hockey a little bit later on. I do want to get into the Red Sox here, but what a day. What a day to be a hockey fan. What a day to be an American. And what a day, hopefully, to begin for the men and to continue for the women dominance for the United States on the international hockey stage. That's really where I'm hoping this goes. And I'm really, really hoping that the NHL can try to bottle some of this up when it comes to the rest of the regular season into the playoffs, and hopefully building a little bit of momentum for the sport. Just a little bit, but we'll get into all of that as the United States has won the gold. And what a couple weeks it was for Freebird and the Eagle Screech here on the station. Also, one of my favorite things that we've done on the afternoon show to this point. Like, come on. I mean, come on. God, I'm going to miss it, but that's okay, because we're going out with a bang here on this Sunday.
USA. USA! USA!
Unbelievable. Yeah. Unbelievable. I can't hear it too many times. There is not enough times that I can hear that particular song. Unbelievable. So let's get into the Red Sox. Couple ups, couple downs from this game here against the Toronto Blue Jays, as Boston has won their first two in the spring. The ups, loved how Jarren Duran looked. Hitting the baseball today. Swing looked great. Line drive seemed like he had plenty of speed. The swing was looking good in the early going. So, I mean, there is still that player that finished top 10 in MVP 2 years ago in there somewhere. And, you know, you wonder, after a season's worth of what, not even if Jaren Duran is going to get traded. It was more when, to where, and for whom he was going to get traded. Does an offseason in which he seems to be constantly on the trade block but not moved act as a vote of confidence for the Red Sox, for their now seemingly part-time left fielder and part-time designated hitter? And is there some of the 2024 magic that can be recaptured? I know that, you know, a lot of Red Sox fans are just kind of out on him. He's kind of just the odd man out. But what if he ends up proving people wrong? And how much does that change things? If I'm not even saying you get, you know, an 8-WAR player like he was 2 years ago, but what if instead of a 250 hitter, it's 270? And what if hitting third kind of opens up a little bit more power and aggression at the plate, and all of a sudden you have some version of that weapon that you had 2 years ago in your lineup this year? I'm not saying that an improved performance from Jaren Duran is the difference between you winning the division and competing for a World Series, but I mean, it certainly does change the dynamic of your lineup when he's going at his best. So I'm fascinated by that. Again, this is extrapolating based on one performance in a spring training game, but it does make you wonder, what does a refreshed and maybe more confident and more secure 2026 Duran have to offer? And is it just temporary? Are the Red Sox going to play him in left fields more times than Roman Anthony to start the season to drive his trade value up? Or do they really see this arrangement working in the long term? It's interesting. So that's a player, obviously, that jumped off the page for Duran, 2-for-3, scored a run as part of his day-to-day, did not drive in anybody, did score a run as part of what was an 11-10 Red Sox win. How about Brian Bello, though? An inning and a third, 4 hits, 4 runs, 1 walk, 2 strikeouts, a nice round ERA of 27. So an interesting point that was made at the end of the broadcast as I was listening to Will and Joe do their sign-off is you're still a part of a group that has some pitching depth. And now all of a sudden you've actually added a frontline starter to pair with Garrett Crochet. So instead of it being where you were at the end of the season, which was Crochet, Bayo, and then kind of figure out the rest with Lucas Giolito and Peyton Tolley and Connelly Early and all that kind of stuff, now you've signed Ranger Suarez, you've acquired via trade Sonny Gray, and then you have Bayo. And then you have just one more spot remaining between Tolley and Early and now Johan Oviedo and Patrick Sandoval and Carter Crawford and, you know, these guys that are going to push Bayo for reps, for spots on the depth chart, for starts. And it just makes you wonder. I mean, he's signed to the kind of ticket that would ensure that he is going to be one of your 5 best starters to start the season. But I would hope that there is a little sense of urgency for Brian Bello, given what the Red Sox did this offseason. They were in dire need of a power bat to add to the middle of this lineup. You don't sign Alonso, you don't sign Kyle Tucker, you don't sign Bo Bichette, and you let Alex Bregman walk after trading Rafael Devers. Your answer in your lineup was Wilson Contreras and just kind of running it back with the group that you had and hoping for the best when it comes to actually hitting the ball out of the ballpark. Meanwhile, and you also didn't really address your bullpen to the point where it does seem like, as Will was kind of surmising during the broadcast, you probably will add one of the remaining free agent left-handers that's on the market. And just to give a little bit of insight into that, that's 32-year-old former Red Sox prospect Jalen Beeks, who last year with Arizona in a number of games, over 60 games, 5-3 record, 3.77 ERA. That's pretty good. I like what that could possibly add. Danny Coulomb, 36 years old. Last year, a tale of two seasons. Starts with Minnesota, 1.16 ERA in 40 games. Then goes to Texas, who was in the midst of trying to compete for a wild card spot, 5.25 ERA in 15 games. Before that, was extremely reliable in two seasons prior with Baltimore, 2.81 and 2.12 ERA. So if you think you can get the Minnesota and Baltimore Danny Coulomb, then that's a guy you take a look at. Joey Lucchese, known to many Mets fans as Joey Fuego, 3.76 ERA with the Giants last year. And then if you want to run it back with Justin Wilson, finished in 61 games with a 3.35 ERA, but he's 38. So I would guess if the Red Sox trusted Justin Wilson to repeat what he did last year, he'd be a member of the Boston Red Sox right now. So I've got my eye on Jalen Beeks. I think out of that group, that's the guy that seems to be coming off of the best and most consistent performance, and especially given the fact that you're probably going to throw, if things go well, high 50s to low 60s games as that other lefty, other than Aroldis Chapman and seemingly Yovani Moran, who seems to be kind of in that conversation as well. So that tangent aside, you let players walk from your bullpen, and now your bullpen is kind of gone from a strength to a weakness. Your lineup was in desperate need of some pop, and you didn't do that. But specific to Brian Baio, you now have two starting pitchers that the Red Sox have brought in who could very easily slot in ahead of Baio in your rotation. Like if you broke camp based on that starting effort for Brian Baio, if you broke camp with Crochet, Suarez, Gray, and Baio as your four, would you be all that surprised? So with Tolley and Early and everybody that I just mentioned kind of nipping at the heels of Brian Baio, I would have hoped for a lot more today, and I am going to continue to hope for a lot more before the World Baseball Classic to maybe see him finally take that step. It was unfair of us to attach the moniker Baby Pedro to him right off the bat. It's nearly impossible for anybody to live up to that kind of moniker, but it's because he flashed that kind of elite potential with the movement on his pitches, with his pitch mix, with the way that he can, when he's at his best, overpower guys. That just hasn't stuck consistently. He was borderline unpitchable. It was just the rule of the roost from the beginning of the season through the end of May last year that he could not complete five innings. I remember I did the pregame show, Sick Brag Bro, and my lock of the game was that he'd get 15 outs. He'd get through five innings. It was against the Braves. I think he went 3 2/3 or maybe got into the fourth. He got shelled. And then all of a sudden, it just clicked. And down the stretch from basically June through the end of the regular season, he was awesome. But then when the playoffs come around, all of a sudden, he just regresses into that shell of what was supposed to be a great pitcher. So can I trust you to be the guy who was supposed to make 30 starts, have an ERA in the threes, and give me a similar output every time you're out there? I feel like that's the biggest question. Can I get the same thing every 5 days? Can I get you close to six innings and three runs, which isn't great, but it's the textbook definition of a quality start. Can I get 30-ish quality starts? I'm sure some will spike better and some will spike worse, but if my general rule of thumb is that I can trust you to be a top three guy in my rotation, I really need to see that this year for me to continue to write you in pen in the Red Sox rotation versus starting to look at you as a trade chip that can bring me in somebody who gives me a better chance to compete for a championship. Now, this is also a Red Sox team that isn't going to win games 8-7 this year. So it puts all the more emphasis on Crochet and Suarez and Gray and Brian Baio and whoever else they choose to round out in that fifth spot. It puts a lot of emphasis on them to be at their best for 30 starts. You simply have to do that in order for this team to compete for a wild card spot this year. If this rotation falters, you are dead in the water this year. Simply dead in the water. So for Brian Baio, an inning in the third, four hits, four runs, a walk, and two strikeouts, just is not going to cut it this time around. But some interesting other notes that came from the general Red Sox circles over the last, call it, 48 hours. First of all, the lineup that was rolled out today. Roman Anthony, your DH, Trevor Story at short, Jaron Duran in left, Wilson Contreras at first, Willier Abreu in right, Caleb Durbin, your third baseman, Rafaela in center, Narvaez, your catcher, and Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, IKF, at second base. Alex Cora said via Christopher Smith of Mass Live, quote, just trying to win this league, so I just felt that's a good way to set it up. But yeah, it's something I envision, talking about could this be an opening day lineup. And it just happened that for the first time in years, what you see early is what you're probably going to see on opening day. So this is the group. Anthony Story, Duran, Contreras, Abreu, Durbin, Rafaela, Narvaez, and Kiner-Falefa. The one potential tweak I could see is Rafaela, who has been basically a career nine hitter and seems to thrive when you put him in center field hitting ninth every single day. You give him that kind of stability, it seems like that's when he is at his best, or at least gives him his best chance to be consistent. The one tweak that I would expect, if things go according to plan, is that Marcelo Meyer starts at second base instead, and he's your seven hitter. Then you've got Narvaez or Connor Wong, depending on who's catching that day, hitting eighth, and Rafaela is your nine hitter. So maybe this is the look that you get against left-handers, and then when Meyer is in, you get that look that I just mentioned against right-handers. Maybe that's the way that they're leaning. Now, Fernando Perez started today. He's a right-hander, but again, they went through, 10 pitchers in total, so it's hard to say, oh yeah, they're doing that based on the starter on the mound. It was going to be one guy each of the nine innings if you're lucky, and it took more than that for this game to mercifully get over, as Will Fleming said. So other than that, that's your lineup, and I want to love it. I really, really, really want to love this group. I had a lot of fun going on the ride of finally seeing the Red Sox compete for and earn a playoff spot last year. I had a ton of fun as part of that. But I can only tell you that I like it. I like certain elements of it. I think, you know, Roman Anthony as your DH is going to be a lot of fun. There are more betting slips that have been placed on Roman Anthony to win MVP than any other player in the American League. He's only got like the eighth best odds, ninth, tenth, somewhere around there. But more people are betting on Anthony to win at the value that he's currently at than any other player. Story, you're just crossing your fingers for more health because you finally saw last year what happens when he stays healthy. Duran is a complete wild card to me. Complete wild card. I think it's interesting to get him a longer look in that number three spot. And that's kind of regardless of if you're playing against righties or lefties. If you get him a bit of a longer stretch there, I'd be curious to see what he can pull off in a season. Contreras, I really like. I wish he wasn't your main offensive ad, but I really like what he brings offensively and defensively in terms of consistency. Pretty much regarded as a top five first baseman defensively in a number of metrics last year. Abreu, I think, gives you the best chance to add the pop that you so desperately need as part of this group. And then 7, 8, 9 is kind of just roll the dice. We'll see what you get. I don't know a darn thing about Caleb Durbin if he can bring anything more than what was a slightly below league average bat. I know he was a Rookie of the Year finalist. I really think it was more of just a lack of competition around him than anything else. I think he's a starter for now. But I would certainly like to see you get yourself into the position near the trade deadline where you can acquire an infielder and he can then become your super utility guy. I think that gives me a much better feeling. Then Narvaez, again, big fan of what I think he's capable of now with a full year as a starter under his belt, and second base is going to be a rotation. It's fine. It's going to win some games. This lineup is going to go through stretches similar to last year where you go, whoa. What has been put into the Red Sox Wheaties this week? They're going to go through those stretches. You have streaky hitters here. And we saw last year when the snowball was rolling downhill, it picked up, maybe a bad example to use with the weather that's coming in the next 24 hours, but when the ball was rolling downhill, it picked up speed exponentially. This group was a very, very motivation-driven, it was momentum-driven was the word I was looking for, but very momentum-driven in terms of how they scored. They were rip-roaring at certain points and dead quiet because they didn't have the offensive catalyst, the game-changer, the guy who could change the game with one swing of the bat. They didn't really have that guy last year, and they still don't have this guy this year. So what you're going to see is a two-week stretch where they are hot as a pistol, and then a two-week stretch where you're losing games 2-0, 3-1. 1-0. And it's going to lead to 84-ish wins is kind of the number I've seen bandied. ESPN's Paul Hemikidis told me, I think it was last weekend, that he had him at 80. Cooper Boardman had them at 90. And I've heard mid-80s pretty consistently. And that will give you a sniff at the wild card. But I wish I was looking at that group of nine and going, you're ready to take that next step. You're ready. I don't even need you to catch the Toronto Blue Jays in 1 year. I just need you to catch the Yankees and then be the main team that's nipping at the heels of the Blue Jays in your division. That's all I really wanted to see from you. And you're relying on the Yankees, given that they're kind of running it back with their group last year, to just naturally regress. And you're relying on your group to progress because both teams kind of just said, yeah, that same group of nine that kind of engaged in a pillow fight in the wild card series. Yeah, that's enough for me. That's all we need. I'll rely on pitching and defense for two of the worst defensive teams in baseball the last 3 years. I'll rely on that and just, you know, get our runs in bunches with one swing of the bat in the case of Aaron Judge for the Yankees, and just kind of chip away death by a thousand cuts for the Red Sox. It's kind of where this group is. It's lukewarm, and you're really relying on your starting pitching, and I would have loved a much more confident start to the spring for Brian Baio based on what we saw today. One more element that I want to get to before we can transition to that unbelievable gold medal game and the unbelievable Olympic tournament that we saw on the ice here over the last couple of weeks. One more element, and it's Marcelo Meyer. And Alex Cora didn't quite give Meyer the most ringing endorsement that you would have expected for a guy with the kind of potential that Meyer has flashed. We'll talk about that and the implications at second base, the one position that seems to still, no matter how many times you slice it after Dustin Pedroia, remain a revolving door for the Red Sox. Plus, we'll take your calls. Any thoughts on the Red Sox if you have them through the rest of the hour at 617-779-7937. Am I being too optimistic? Am I being too pessimistic on the Red Sox? Plenty more Sox talk coming up next. Back here on WEEI, Dan Ball with you. 617-779-7937 is the phone number. Red Sox, winners now of three straight games, if you count the Northeastern drubbing. And, you know, I saw people on Twitter, Tristan, at the beginning of Friday, the true pessimistic Red Sox fan, when they were losing 2-1 to Northeastern, like, oh, boy.
Here we go again.
Here we go.
I've seen this movie before.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of almost the real just like battered and bruised, well, quote unquote fan. I don't even really call you a fan. If you're like, yeah, I want to see Northeastern beat the Red Sox.
Yeah, if you have a grand, you know, expansive take on the 2026 Red Sox after one scrimmage against Northeastern,
right,
I think you have some deeper things to consider about yourself.
Yeah, exactly. There are plenty of professionals that can help. I know I've heard better help ads here on this station.
I was
going to
say, the station, like, advertises some.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And they're available for you 24-7. So 1 o'clock first pitch, 7 o'clock first pitch, your therapist is there for you if that's how you feel. But anyways, aside from that point, Red Sox beat Northeastern. They're now 2-0 in Grapefruit League play. The scuttlebutt going around a couple of days ago came when Alex Cora was asked about Marcelo Meyer. With Marcelo, we'll give him the baton, but he has to run. If he wants to be the starting second baseman in Cincinnati, there's a lot of work to do. It's not a given that he's second baseman or third baseman for the team. There's a lot of things that he needs to show us this spring, and we expect him to do that because he's that talented. But at the same time, there's a lot of guys that can do the job. It's a really interesting conversation to be had about Meyer, and then just the general arrangement of everything that isn't first base for the Red Sox. Without the presence of Alex Bregman at third, it really gives you, instead of one position in the infield that you're kind of rotating through, it gives you two decisions that you have to make on a game-in and game-out basis. So you have Caleb Durbin, who you acquired. You have Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who you signed. You have Marcelo Meyer, who you drafted. You have Romy Gonzalez, who is the incumbent, who is kind of off to a slow start, and I think is working through some things here in the early part of camp, which is a shame, because if you don't have him at 100%, that ended up being a very quietly, extremely instrumental part of your success last year, was Romy Gonzalez. And then I think there's also the ultimate X factor, which is Seydon Rafaela. And I understand that Alex Cora told the media earlier this week that Rafaela and Willy Abreu are, when they're in the lineup, they're everyday outfielders. And I get that, and I want that, and I appreciate that, but I don't believe that, because things change. Injuries happen. Guys go down. And you also have two of your four spots in the infield that are just gigantic question marks right now. Durbin, you now have a rookie year's worth of statistics in front of you. He was a promising prospect before he got moved from the Yankees to the Brewers. Came up, had a very good rookie year. Doesn't, you know, hit the ball very hard, but plus defender, can get on base, and seems like he has another gear that he can get to. So you're hoping that he's a starter more times than he's not. I think Romy Gonzalez is in there against lefties, assuming that he's healthy. And then there's the question of Marcelo Meyer, who ends up being roughly a 220 hitter in the games that he played. Looked very, very good defensively at third base. But he is kind of your ultimate infield X factor, because if you can get him to take a step forward and have a fully healthy season, which I do ultimately think begins in AAA, and I think there's two reasons for that. You'd like him to get some positive at-bats under his belt to start the season and really be able to get the feeling of dominating. I think you'd love to see that for a month to 6 weeks, and we know that the Red Sox love to manipulate service time. So if they can check that box and you can use that as a chance for Meyer to get some reps at second base, get comfortable there defensively, and get the bat to the point where he's ready for major league competition, then I think you call him up, you install him as your starting second baseman, and hopefully you just let him sit there. And I'm hoping that even implies some kind of matchup against lefties. I know that was a crusade that I took on for weeks last year, that Meyer should be playing every day regardless of righty versus lefty. Probably in hindsight, maybe a little too strong on that. You also now have a full season of knowing that Roman Gonzalez is a damn good hitter. So if that's the one spot where you want to emphasize, hey, I'm going to go with my platoon here and I'm going to get the best out of both of these guys, I think I can understand where you're coming from, because the injury risk with Meyer is no joke. So if you can lighten the burden on him ever so slightly, say it's two out of every three games, you know, two righties for a lefty, something like that. If you can do that, I think it gives you that plan. Start him in the minors for a month to 6 weeks, get the swing going, get him comfortable at second, then call him up, and then he's your second baseman against righties, with Roman Gonzalez as your second baseman against lefties. I think that gives you the best chance to get the best out of him, because you are running on borrowed time as it pertains to Trevor Story being your everyday shortstop. I think there's a breakdown factor that you have to factor into all of this, to where you could be talking about the 2027 Red Sox, knowing that Story's under contract for another 2 years after this one, with Story being at second, and hopefully Meyer ready to be installed as your shortstop. That's what I would guess that your hope is, but he needs to be able to start somewhere at the end of March and finish at the end of September, hopefully the end of October somewhere, and not have an injury that derails his season. I need to see that, because from the majors down to the minors, at every level, there's been something that's kept him from playing a full season and really just going through a natural progression of his development. So if you can get Marcelo Meyer somewhere in the, with time down in AAA and a platoon factor, 90 to 100 games, if you could get him into triple digits, maybe even wishful thinking at this point, but if you can, Romy plays the rest and you rotate in Caleb Durbin, IKF, and whoever else you need to, I think that gives you the best chance for Meyer to take a step forward in 2027. And that also implies, yes, Tristan, go ahead.
Caleb Durbin last year with Milwaukee, obviously you're talking about him right now. He, 11 homers in 136 games, 53 runs batted in, WAR of 2.8 last year in his rookie year with Milwaukee.
Yeah, I mean, useful player, but not a guy that I feel overly comfortable about being relied upon for 150 plus games.
Sure, but like, how often does it come up that a rookie of the year candidate, you know, like Durbin, is on the trade market? How often does that come up? I think that's a very shrewd move on Breslow's part. I think that's going to be one of the cogs in the machine that is the 26 Sox.
I agree, and I hope that you're right. I just the natural pessimist in me sees a Rookie of the Year finalist be on the trade block and asks, why? Because wouldn't the Milwaukee Brewers like to have a Rookie of the Year finalist as their everyday third baseman? That's just that, and I hope that I'm just being negative just for, you know, being a battered and bruised Red Sox fan. I wonder what Milwaukee didn't see in him that the Red Sox did, if that makes sense.
Gift horses, man.
Yeah, there. Hey, you know what? You're honestly, you're right about that, but it's an interesting conversation. It really is, because you have two of your four spots in the infield that are, I think, for my money, completely up for grabs. And then you have Story, who you're hoping can stay healthy, and if not, that makes it even more confusing. And then there's the Tristan Casas factor in it all. And I have zero idea what that looks like. All I can tell you is, get your tickets in Worcester from the beginning of their season at the, I'm assuming it's the beginning of April, late March, early April through like the end of May. Because if you're seeing potentially Meyer and Casas and Christian Campbell and all these guys that are like may factor into the Red Sox and may not, and then you could get Tolley or Early, or I know Oviedo has options back if he doesn't make it as your fifth starter. Like, there's some good talent that you could see with the at the Woo this year. So just put a pin in that if you're looking for the family experience, but you don't want to pay Fenway Park prices, and I can't blame you for that. Okay, we'll leave the Red Sox conversation there. Again, 11-10 victors, the Boston Red Sox over the Toronto Blue Jays in the spring. They are back at it tomorrow afternoon, 1:05 first pitch against the Tampa Bay Rays on the road. And that is how things are looking heading into another busy week of Red Sox spring training baseball. You heard it. You heard the eagle screech. You heard it. We had Freebird coming in because the United States has won the gold. We'll talk about it and what this could mean for the United States program and hopefully the NHL, because I think there's an interesting element to this, and we'll talk about that next. You're damn right we are. You are damn right we are. Champions of the hockey world in 2026. Welcome back. It's WEEI. I'm Dan Ball. Thanks so much for riding with us here. I'm taking you up until 6 o'clock today, and then myself and my man Tristan Andrew, who's back behind the glass, and everybody else is hunkering down for a snowpocalypse 2026. And the fun world of snowbanks and spot savers and all of the other things that are a part of the greater Boston world that I am learning on the fly come back in our better than ever this week. So good luck out there. Again, if you've still got things to get, it looks like it's still a couple hours out. Should be kind of in the 9 to 10 o'clock range based on a quick little glance at the radar when things really start to hit. So good luck. Stay safe. Stay warm. Yes, Tristan.
Yeah, the timeline has shifted. When I looked at it last night, it was saying around like 6 or 7, which was like, oh, that's great. That's like right when I'm getting out of here.
But, yeah, exactly.
But now that it's like 9 o'clock, I'm feeling a little adventurous. Like, ooh, maybe I can like go out to Market Basket or something.
Yeah.
And, like maybe, and it's foolish. It is for naught, because I literally went to Market Basket the night before the last big storm, and I swear to you, you could not move in there.
Yeah.
It was shoulder to shoulder.
Crazy.
The stinking local news was there recording people. It was a madhouse.
Yeah. And so I would imagine that it is still the case with a lot of people who are realizing exactly what you said. Like, oh, I can sneak out before dinner and get my stuff and maybe just squeak in under the radar there before everything starts. So, yeah, that's kind of where things are sitting right now. So if you have plans tonight, then I would cancel them. But the United States gave us all plans this morning. 8:10 a.m. puck drop, United States and Canada. Ends up a 2-1 overtime victory for the United States of America in the gold medal game. Matt Boldy got the scoring started at the 6-minute mark from Austin Matthews and Quinn Hughes. Cale Makar tied it at the 18-16 mark. That's Cale Makar, pride of UMass, just to make sure that everybody knows that information. Assisted by pride of Quinnipiac University, Devon Taves, that tied it at 1 after 2. No goals in the third, and then just a minute 41 into 3-on-3 overtime. Jack Hughes is fourth of the tournament from Zach Werenski, and the goaltender, Connor Hellebuck. That ends up being your game winner in overtime. 2-1, the United States sweeps in the hockey tournament. The women beat Canada and in overtime, and then the men beat Canada in overtime. Same score, same exact circumstances. It was just over 4 minutes into overtime for Megan Keller and 1:41 in for Jack Hughes. Early thoughts on the tournament. United States was kind of what I thought they would be in terms of their ranking. They were the second best team in this tournament, just in terms of the skill that you saw. The Canadians had the, without Sidney Crosby, had the three best players on the ice entering play. And I think you saw that. McDavid, MacKinnon, and Makar. Those three starting out overtime. It's impressive that Canada did not end things in the first shift in the extra period based on those three. Macklin Celebrini played at BU, number one overall pick, now plays for the San Jose Sharks, is going to be really good for a really long time. I think when this tournament comes around, God willing, as long as Gary Bettman allows NHL players to continue playing in the tournament, which I'm hoping based on the relative success of this one that we continue to see that in 2030 and beyond. You're going to see Macklin Celebrini be a face of the league and a face of the tournament. And it's going to go McDavid, Celebrini, and then everybody else at that point. I think that's kind of where this thing is headed with him. But that's okay, because even though maybe skill-wise the United States weren't quite as star-laden as the Canadians were, as we saw on display today, they had that fight. They had just they were able to respond to the adversity of playing the all-star team to end all all-star teams in a way that I really wasn't sure that we'd see. And I didn't know about this group until we saw it, plain and simple. Like, they responded to a barrage in which Connor Hellebuyck had to make over 40 saves between regulation and overtime, faced 42 shots, made 41 saves. Tell you what, the rumors and the accusations against Connor Hellebuyck not being a big-time goaltender, which has been earned through numerous falters on very good Winnipeg Jets teams in the playoffs, that got erased in this tournament, and that specifically got erased today. He made, given the circumstances, one of the top, five saves that I've seen. That reach your paddle back behind you save on the rebound there for Taves in front of the net. If he scores that, I think we're talking about we're talking about a different tournament. Talking about a different color medal that's being worn by the Americans, I think. Charlie McAvoy gets in there behind him, kind of makes a save on one. There were three, four opportunities in that third period for Canada where you just kind of scratch your head and go, maybe the hockey gods are on your side. And sometimes it's that. It's a mix of opportunistic scoring and puck luck. Sometimes it really is as simple as that. Now, granted, the Canadians had just a little bit of puck luck on their side. The double doink at the end of the second period, that could have changed things, responding right after the Makar goal. That really, really would have made an interesting third period if the United States had to defend a lead in the third. But that wasn't the case. And overall, I mean, I think the overall tournament was just gangbusters, man. Sweden bouncing back from a terrible start to be a factor once again, probably regarded as the third best team in the tournament. They look great. The Slovakians getting to where they did. I know that it wasn't the greatest end to the tournament. But, you know, they brought more than I think a lot of people expected. They're really, other than Italy and France, I mean, there wasn't a team that you looked at and went, this team can't hang. And Tristan,
Latvia.
Yeah.
Even Latvia was showing that they could hang around.
That's kind of what what I was curious to get your thoughts on is that other than the host team and you know, poor France out there, the rest of your bracket had teams that brought something, that brought the fight, that had superstars. And this was a really cool commentary 12 years after the last time that the NHL players were in the Olympics, of where the game of hockey is. And I really loved to see the depth of talent that was on display in the tournament.
Oh, absolutely. I would have to agree with that wholesale, just because I was talking to one of my friends the other night. They were really watching more for the women's team. And I mentioned the fact that, like, oh, you know, USA and Canada, the men are going for the gold medal. Wouldn't that be something if both men's and women's teams won? And they were like, well, no. And I had to come in and correct them, because, like, you know, rising tides lift all ships. And if more PWHL players are getting exposure through the Winter Games, which they have.
Right.
Same with the NHL players. That only stands to help hockey as a whole. And I know it's easier to sit here in Boston, a hockey city through and through, and say those things. But I really think that because of this Winter Olympic Games in Milan, hockey, men's, women's, whatever, is getting more exposure than ever before.
Yeah, and I hope that continues. I mean, it's a great point. Austin Matthews is from Arizona. Like, that's the captain of Team USA, and I know he was a bit of a shrinking violet as the games got bigger in terms of importance, but that's still a face of USA hockey that is from, like you talk about, a non-traditional hockey market. So do you see this having a ripple effect to where maybe some of the youth programs gain a little bit of steam? I don't know. It's one of the most unfortunate things about the game of hockey, as you know, somebody who experienced it and whose parents experienced it, and I'm sure a ton of people out there have this same kind of experience. It's an expensive sport to play. you have to, especially for kids that are at the, like going into the preteen and teen years where you're constantly growing into and out of things. It's new sticks, it's new skates, it's new gloves, it's a new helmet. It's a helmet that matches the team they're playing for. It's a shell that covers your pants that matches the team you're playing for.
Oh my God,
tryout fees, it's registration fees, it's game fees, it's paying the coaches, paying for ice time. It's all this kind of stuff that goes into just getting a kid out on the ice, and then you have to teach them how to skate, and you have to hope that they can take that into actually learning and picking up how to play the game. So there are so many barriers for entry for the game of hockey that you don't see for basketball, you don't see for soccer, you don't see for a sport like lacrosse, which is growing exponentially right now and almost jumping over baseball in terms of the travel levels and the high school levels and all that. There's so many different barriers for entry that they still need to find a way to try to make it more accessible, to subsidize, to make it easier to get secondhand equipment so you don't have to pay. I mean, seeing some of the numbers on a new hockey stick, if you walk through Pure Hockey or your local hockey shop, it blows your mind. It's unbelievable to get to the top of the line.
I did 10 years in retail. A lot of that was spent at sporting goods chains. And yeah. I can tell you firsthand, hockey is going to be probably one or two, the second or highest most expensive sport that your child can get into and play. But having said that, I think that with the U.S. sweeping gold in men's and women's hockey,
yeah,
we're going to start seeing a broader acceptance of it, even at that lower youth level, like we did with soccer over the last couple decades and how soccer has the foothold in America that it has now. I think we'll see something like that. And, hopefully, people like to make fun of trickle down economics, not to get political, but hopefully that can trickle down. And so that, more people from Arizona, let's say,
yeah,
can get their kid into hockey and they can become the next Auston Matthews.
And so that then, to me, puts more onus on the National Hockey League, who finally let off the reins and allowed their players to play in this tournament. I would guess at least partially spurred on by the success of the Four Nations and the previous success of the World Cup of Hockey. They finally realized that, hey, even though this is not an NHL sanctioned event, the exposure that our players are going to get, the exposure that our game gets, just the general interaction with the sport of hockey that we get from a 3-week stretch, internationally speaking, is worth more both now and in the future. It's an investment in the sport's future to allow these guys to continue to play at the highest international level. So now the question becomes, can the NHL capitalize on this? Can you see this reflected in growth of those grassroots youth travel programs? Can you see growth in attendance in terms of ratings, in terms of social media interaction? Can the I give a crap about hockey group grow because of this? And it's not an overly nuanced answer. I certainly hope so, because it's an awesome, awesome sport. It's a great sport to watch on TV, but it is nothing compared to being in the building and actually watching it, especially at the NHL level. I grew up in college hockey rinks watching it at that level too. It's awesome. You have a number of unbelievable college hockey programs in this area that can also be a part of. And I'm glad you brought up the PWHL, because they play out of both Saugus at UMass Lowell and now at Gannis at BU. And that is an awesome product as well. And they do a great job in terms of putting together the game day experience in addition to the hockey that you're seeing on the ice. The sport is growing, and I hope that the NHL can continue to use opportunities like this to modernize, to grow, to try to expand your reach, to maybe put some pressure on your TV on your TV contracts to make it seem like they actually care about the sport that they're paying so much money to advertise. Yeah, Tristan.
I was going to bring up TV, because that's a big part of it. And this is a problem that is plaguing basically all of professional sports right now, is TV rights, where you can watch your teams, when you can watch them.
Yeah.
Until this gets sorted out on a broader scale, I think it's going to be hard for any pro league to really grab a foothold if you use like the NFL as like your barometer for that.
Yeah, anything not named the NFL, or I guess college football as the extension of that, is fighting for an increasingly distant second place. And now there are rumors that Roger Goodell is going to go back to some of these TV providers and go, hey, you paid whatever it is, $5 billion this time around, now it's 10. And hey, the contract was up in 5 years, but now it's up now. And so you then have rumors that Gary Bettman has been initiating conversations with the TV, the TV providers, and all of a sudden they're clutching their pearls. You know, we need to know if we're about to have to double our $5 billion investment in the NFL. So if I'm ESPN, I can't give you an answer on hockey right now. So I don't know. I don't know where this leads. If it could lead to one TV entity, and a lot of people mentioned TNT and TBS and the Turner family because they just lost the NBA. Let's use that for example. If the NHL can at some point land on one TV provider, one family, so to speak, that puts all their resources into it, that gives A-plus broadcasters, broadcast quality, audio, visual, studio crews, social media engagement. If they build up the event that is hockey, I think you can start to get a little bit more positive momentum. But it just, it's this damn reputation of this league. They just have not been able to capitalize seemingly at any point on these major events that have happened. So I'm hoping, and the texture brings it up, 774, expensive, time consuming, especially 4 to 5 a.m. mornings, but worth it all. That is absolutely what I'm saying. And the NHL, both financially and just in terms of their reach and the eyeballs that they bring in, has the chance to maybe help subsidize it for certain groups around America. Make it easier, make the barriers of entry easier to clear for people, and try to get more people involved in the sport so that you can kind of start to build the ecosystem that kids are paying attention. So now teenagers are paying attention. So young adults are, with their newfound money out of college, are paying attention and going to games. And then you start to build that ecosystem that made basketball so successful, basically post-NHL lockout in 2003. So, Tristan, I've given you a pie-in-the-sky view of where I hope this goes. I don't think it's going to happen, but I really, really do hope it does.
I agree with you, Dan. And the ironic thing about all this, too, one last thing. You know, NBC, in my opinion, had a perfectly fine NHL presentation until they lost the rights a couple years ago. Since then, TNT and ESPN have held the rights, and it has just not been the same. And I think part of that is it moving away from NBC, in part Doc Emmerich retiring. But be that as it may, you still turned on NBC this morning to watch USA beat Canada. So who gets the last laugh there?
Yeah, I would absolutely entertain an NBC reunion. And actually, the texter who asked for your name, Tristan Andrews, my producer and cohort today, said NBC question mark. I'd absolutely entertain that. If you can get now the NBC, the relaunched NBC Sports Network, which not a lot of people talked about, and then the growing presence of Peacock that you can stream some of these on, I'd talk about that. I think the Turner family, they rebranded True TV, you know, the Impractical Jokers Network. They rebranded that as more of a sports slant. So you could do that on top of TBS and True TV. I think there's something there. There are ways that the NHL can try to leverage this so that they're getting the coverage that the sport deserves, because ESPN just friggin' rolls the ball out there on their coverage. It is such a joke. The technical side of things, I'm not a huge fan of most of the talent. I like Bob Wischusen, who calls Jets games on the radio, but I don't know. Past that, the list is pretty short of people that I see on ESPN's coverage and go, yeah, that's who I want. I feel like that person properly represents my sport.
Good friend Sean McDonough, I believe, is the number one announcer on ESPN.
And
he does
more
a fabulous
Sean.
Job.
I need more Sean
too.
He called
absolutely.
Like seven games last year.
Yeah.
Where's Sean?
He called more games for the Sox on EEI than he did NHL last year.
Exponentially so. And I don't get it. I'm sure it's just availability and you know, contract stipulations and whatever, but more Sean McDonough, and he has a lot of fans, especially in this area. I am one of them. Tristan is clearly as well. Sean McDonough is a big game broadcaster. The more you put a guy like Sean McDonough on your game, the more I'm going to hear it and go, this game means something. If I'm a college football fan, but I hear Sean McDonough calling a Saturday night primetime NHL game on ESPN or ABC or whatever, I'm going to hear that and go, oh, this game must mean something. Sean's not just calling any game that's out there. So it's that kind of concept that you bring up, that again, it's an investment. It's something that these networks have to be willing to do that they're not. And I just, you hope that the momentum from this Olympic tournament could maybe compel the leagues and the networks and the different wings of promoting the game of hockey to kind of grow. But I don't know. It seems to be asking a lot of this leadership regime in the NHL. to make decisions like that and be forward thinking and try to do things like that. So we'll see where it goes. But just when it comes to just in a vacuum, this tournament, such a great, great showing for the Americans, who I really do think have a chance to do some special stuff for a long time. Connor Hellebuck's got at least one more tournament left in him. I think that the Hughes brothers and the Tkachuk brothers are going to be the faces of United States hockey for a long time. Jack Eichel is still in his prime. Auston Matthews, say what you will about him as a winner or a leader or whatever else, but he's got a chance to be there. So the Americans on the men's side, I think, are in great shape. And the women are going to dominate, because this group that they had out there this year, young. It was a bunch of players in their early mid-20s. Their best players, the MVP of the tournament, is still in college. It hasn't even turned pro yet. So that's the level that the women's side is at. So it should be a lot of fun in 4 years' time, crossing our fingers that NHL players are still in it when we get to 2030. 617-779-7937 is the phone number. Coming up next, ESPN Radio's Freddie Coleman joins us. A lot to get to there. The NFL and its offseason. The NBA and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown potentially reuniting for the Celtics very, very soon. Plus Olympics and all that with one of the very best on the national radio scene. That comes after Tristan Andrew gets you caught up on what's trending.
Now, here's what's trending on WEEI.
23 minutes after the hour on Sunday, February 22nd, here's what's trending now on WEEI. As Dan Ball has been telling you, in Milan today, Team USA men's hockey erased a 46-year gold medal drought when Jack Hughes scored the winning goal. 2-1 was the final score in overtime, and here is how it sounded.
Watch the clock, it comes! Jack Hughes wins it! The golden goal for the United States for the first time since the 1980 miracle! The United States takes the gold!
Kenny Albert on the call over the NBC television network. USA goaltender Connor Hellebuck had the game of his life, blocking all but one of the 42 Canadian shots on goal. Hughes and Hellebuck, along with Boston Bruins Charlie McAvoy and Jeremy Swayman, have cemented their place in Team USA hockey history with America's first gold medal in men's hockey since the Miracle on Ice team of 1980. As we wrap up the final day of action in Milano-Cortina, let's check out the medal count of this, the 25th Winter Olympiad. Norway leads with 41, USA in second with 33, host nation Italy with 30, and in gold medals, Norway leads with 18, USA with 12, and the Netherlands and Italy in a tie with 10. The closing ceremony is underway as we speak. You can watch that on NBC and Peacock. Spring training day two, the Red Sox took on the Toronto Blue Jays at JetBlue Park. Nate Eaton had two doubles in the sixth inning alone, a six-run sixth inning, as the Red Sox eked out an 11-10 victory today. They are now 2-0 in spring training play. Grapefruit League action continues tomorrow when the Red Sox visit the division rival Tampa Bay Rays. First pitch from Port Charlotte, scheduled for 1:05 Monday on WEEI AM 850, the Odyssey app, and along the Shaw's and Star Market WEEI Red Sox Network. Shaw's, proud to be local since 1860. And finally, New England is staring down the barrel of what will go down in history as the blizzard of 26. Walls of wet and heavy snow are set to blanket the region with at least a foot of snow, possibly two in spots, beginning tonight. This nor'easter is part of a destructive bicoastal storm that will dump snow from the South Shore all the way up into central Maine. Widespread power outages are expected, wind gusts at up to 70 miles an hour, and the National Weather Service has issued a rare blizzard warning that covers most of southern New England through Monday night. So please, drive safely tonight and tomorrow. Look after your neighbors and keep it here on EEI. We'll get through it together. Stay tuned for more of the Dan Ball Show after these messages. I'm Tristan Andrew. That's what's trending now on New England Sports Original WEEI Boston.
Back here on WEEI, 617-779-7937 is the phone number. We'll be joined by ESPN Radio's Freddie Coleman in just a couple of moments to discuss all things Olympic, NFL offseason, NBA, and much more. But before we get to him, Seth is in New Jersey on Team USA. Hi, Seth. How are you?
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes, sir.
I got a few comments. What an exciting game. My heartbeat was dangerous. A few things. Number one, Quinn Hughes and Zach Werenski are two defensemen who I've known are great NHL defensemen, but you never get to see them, especially Hughes, because for most of his career he played out in, you know, Pacific time and for a bad team that nobody cared about.
Right.
And to really get to see him in that spotlight, what a player, what a skater.
Yeah.
I mean, when the Americans were struggling and being dominated during tough points of that game, you just said, get the puck to Quinn Hughes. He'll know what to do with it. That guy is unbelievable. The second thing is, he was paired up with Charlie McAvoy, and that's maybe the best defensive pairing I've ever seen in my life. And, you know, McAvoy, he was more staying at home, but did you see him in the net blocking goals? I mean, the guy was unbelievable.
Made a save behind Hellebuck. Yeah.
Yes. Just fantastic. And then I could go on and on, but the last thing I'll mention is, you know, the other guy that I haven't seen much of, who I was really impressed by, was Werenski. What a player. You know, he's a big guy who has those skills. But on that game winner, everybody coming down the ice was struggling with the puck and being bothered by a Canadian player and just barely managed to keep control of it. And then when Werenski gets the puck in the corner and MacKinnon comes at him, he's got 2 inches and 10 pounds on MacKinnon, and he just pushes him out of the way and makes that pass. And that was an absolute thing of beauty. Obviously, Hellebuck got screwed for not being the MVP, because he absolutely was.
Yeah, no doubt about that, Seth. Thank you for the call. I appreciate the thoughts there. A couple things to get to. Yeah, Quinn Hughes, and I mentioned this on the afternoon show last Thursday when the U.S. played their first preliminary game. Tage Thompson, but more specifically Quinn Hughes, the two main players for the United States that were not included in the Four Nations faceoff, were both huge, huge, huge X factors in this tournament. Tage Thompson was left off the roster because he wasn't viewed as a fit for what the team was trying to do. And Quinn Hughes was injury related right before the beginning of the tournament. It was deemed that he wasn't good enough to go. And, you know, they were mentioning it during the intermission between the third period and overtime today. Quinn Hughes's motor, his physical ability is such that they'd essentially just throw him out on the ice and he'd play all of overtime, or he'd get to the bench and he would let the coaching staff know when he was ready to go. And that's just how much better than everybody else he was in this tournament. He and his brother Jack were two of the biggest, probably two of the three or four biggest reasons that you win this. It's probably Quinn Hughes, Connor Hellebuck, and Jack Hughes in that order, in terms of like your three stars of the tournament, so to speak. So Quinn, yeah, a kid that played out in Vancouver, so you didn't see him much unless they were playing the Bruins, unless you were, you know, a sicko and watching the NHL Network after midnight like me. You didn't see a lot of his game. But yeah, to see the way that he just would go, 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 and then just the smooth nature with which he moved with the puck and moved through the offensive zone and would just make little quick stick handles so that even the best forecheckers for the Canadians had no chance to take the puck off of him. You could not knock the puck off of Quinn Hughes. And the point that Seth makes also about that pairing, Quinn Hughes at his best made Charlie McAvoy largely at his best. I mean, he took a couple of penalties, but it's Chuck McAvoy. Like, that's you have to bake that into the pie with him. He's gonna get beat to holy hell. Like, you look at the poor kid's face after the tournament. You're like, my God, man, you could never just play an easy game. It is always a million miles an hour for Charlie McAvoy, and that's what I think Bruins fans have finally settled on with Charlie McAvoy. Is he a first-pairing defenseman in the NHL? Yes, and a damn good one. But if he has to carry a pairing, like say when he's paired with Mason Lauri, for example, when you have to carry the other guy on that pairing, McAvoy is not able to do that. There's really only a handful of guys in the league, and you saw a boatload of them in this game. Cale Makar, Quinn Hughes, Zach Werenski being three, just that were in this game alone, that can carry a top pairing, that can play upwards of 25 minutes a night, regardless of who they're playing with. McAvoy needs somebody who is going to be able to balance him so that you have more of an offensive-minded, puck-moving defenseman with him that's elite. Then that brings the best out of McAvoy. But if he has to worry about essentially babysitting the other guy that's on his pairing in addition to playing his own game, it then knocks him out of his own game, which is why everybody saw him in the Four Nations last year before his injury and went, what is going on with Charlie McAvoy? Why is he playing like his hair's on fire in this tournament, but he can't do that with the Bruins? A, it's 82 games, so you got to pace yourself. But B, he's paired with elite talent, so it makes him better. Yes, Tristan?
Just wanted to mention, just to support your argument, time on ice. Charlie McAvoy is the only guy on Team USA not named Jack Eichel or Quinn Hughes that had more than 20 minutes on the ice during today's game.
Right. There you go. That's your perfect example, because he was your second best defenseman. And because he's not the quarterback of your first power play, that's kind of where you see the discrepancy there. But if McAvoy is the 1A to your 1B as your top pairing in an NHL team, you love how it looks. But if he's your 1 to a distant second best defenseman on your pairing, that's when it kind of weighs his game down. So that's kind of just some of the nuances of where I think McAvoy is in terms of, like, is he elite best in the league? No. But can he be part of a damn good pairing? Yes, and you saw that as part of this tournament. So the two of them were awesome, and Zach Werenski needs to get his ass out of Columbus. He needs to go play on a team that has a chance to win a Stanley Cup, because if he moves to a major market team, Boston, if he moves to a major market team, all of a sudden the conversation around him changes, because he is elite on a team that gives him nothing to work with. And unfortunately, his elite play is not just lost in the time difference between Boston and Vancouver. His elite play is lost in the fact that Columbus is just a perennial non-factor. They cannot escape the mediocrity of being right on that wild card cut line. So, yeah, he was one of those guys where you put him on the national stage and you realize, oh, this is what the league has been missing. You're missing seeing this guy be a top 10 defenseman in the league, if not top 5 on some years. But That's a guy who definitely benefited from having the amplified stage, was Zach Werenski. And good for Connor Hellebuyck, man. UMass Lowell product, drafted in the 5th round by the Winnipeg Jets, and has just gone through a year. I mean, he was the MVP of the NHL last year. Winnipeg was a President's Trophy team, and they just flame out in the playoffs again. And that's kind of been the story of the career of Connor Hellebuyck. So does a guy who steps up and plays the best game of his life on the biggest stage of his life, can he kind of grab that now for his post-30 back half of his career in Winnipeg or maybe somewhere else? Because that team is god-awful this year. He won't have to worry about competing for a Stanley Cup this year. But is that something that changes for him? Does it change for Austin Matthews, the captain of Team USA, the captain of the Maple Leafs? Or is he a guy that can't necessarily stand up to the big stages, as has been showed as his NHL career? Go ahead, Tristan.
I am wondering, wondering if what Jeremy Swayman must think about his teammate Hellebuyck. Yeah, he's got the gold medal just like his teammate, but I'm wondering how this will hit for Swayman as he now has to go back and 10 goal for the Bruins for the rest of the season.
I wonder about that as well, especially because his one game in the tournament, he let in a goal from center ice, among other errors in net. They won the game, so, you know, you can't take that away from him, but it wasn't necessarily an awe-inspiring performance for Swayman, who I have to give credit to is having a very good season, especially compared to the bar that he set for himself last year. But yeah, that's another guy who I think both internationally and in the NHL, you just wonder, is this a top 10 guy? Is this a team that can backstop a team to a Stanley Cup or backstop a team to a gold medal? And I think the answer to both of those questions at the moment is no. Or it's at very least the answer is incomplete. I don't know yet. It's not a complete grade. I have to see him falter on that stage before I know it. But I mean, he had some great chances with Linus Allmark to do some significant winning, and it just didn't pan out. So I don't know. He continues to be a guy who Bruins fans just want an answer on. Is he our goaltender of the future, or is he nothing more than just a platoon goalie that's now getting paid to be a number one goalie? And he hasn't done enough for himself for a long enough amount of time to prove that he is a true number one, a guy you can play 60-plus games, and certainly hasn't proven that he's a guy that can backstop you to 16 wins in a Stanley Cup. That has not happened yet for sure. So I'm very fascinated by that as well, as Swayman continues to flummox Bruins fans as the season gets underway later this week. Okay, we're wrapping things up here on WEEI. We're handing you over to national coverage via the Infinity Sports Network, Westwood One Sports, all that kind of stuff coming up at the top of the hour. So some spare thoughts, including the Celtics getting back in action tonight against the Los Angeles Lakers, and maybe one final chance for them to see LeBron James after not seeing Steph Curry a couple of nights ago. That and more coming up as we wrap things up here on WEEI.
Dan Ball on WEEI.
Boy, Tristan, this really gives the ominous feel. What's going on with this rejoin here?
Oh, my gosh. Our listeners in Maine will know exactly what this is. This is the theme music from WCSH-TV's Storm Center coverage. They've been using this music for their winter weather coverage for, I don't know, longer than I've been alive, surely. But I felt that was probably a fitting way to wrap this show up and go into this blizzard, Dan.
Yeah, I would say so. We are we're the last line of local defense here on WEEI before we hand you over to national coverage here at the top of the hour. So also happening just after the top of the hour, the Boston Celtics taking on the Los Angeles Lakers. 6:30 tip on NBC. What a couple weeks it's been for NBC, going from the gold medal game today into the closing ceremonies into Celtics and Lakers.
Yeah, and they got MLB in the next few weeks. They got the MLB package back. So I think I read somewhere NBC is going to be the first network ever to have a day of the week carved out for a nightly primetime nationally telecast game between football, basketball, and now Major League Baseball.
Crazy. And I also saw them announce that they're doing the same thing that I think it was the Roku broadcast did, where they're having local analysts. So it'll be Jason Benetti, who calls games for the Chicago White Sox, Chicago White Sox. No, he's now with Detroit. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So Benetti is the one play-by-play guy, and then they'll have an analyst from each team. So you should be getting Sunday Night Loomer, if things go according to plan.
Jason Benetti and Lou Merlone in the booth is going to be must-see TV. Those two
music
guys.
Music to your ears.
Absolutely. And Jason Benetti, he does not get enough love, and he gets so much love already. Jason Benetti is, for my money, probably one of the better baseball play-by-play voices up there with Sean McDonough.
100%. Right there with you.
And so, Joe Castiglione,
yeah,
and Will Fleming,
right.
Obviously.
That's right, absolutely. Two of the two best, and then everybody else is fighting for second. But anyways, so aside from that, it is Sunday Night Basketball tonight. Celtics 36-19 coming off of a win against the Warriors after the restart from the All-Star break. The Lakers 34-21. Clean injury report on both sides other than Jason Tatum returning. And Justin Turpin wrote on our website yesterday, quote, there's no date for him to return, even though now you're seeing multiple different flex dates going to national primetime coverage at the beginning of March. So read into that however you want. Five-part documentary on NBC. Couple games in primetime on NBC to start the month of March, but sure, no date for return for Jason Tatum as he gets things underway. But should be a fun game tonight. Last thing I wanted to get to, and if the Red Sox didn't take up 3.5 hours of our time here this afternoon, the afternoon show on Friday ranked their top five Patriots needs. They ended up with edge rusher number one, an offensive weapon at number two. That was whittled down both between wide receiver and tight end. Offensive line was their third need on their list, with a free safety or somebody potentially replacing Jalen Hawkins at four, and depth at the linebacker position was number five, with the honorable mention being a punter as Bryce Behringer goes into the final year of his rookie deal. I was a little surprised by that, and I think a flashy edge rusher in order to add another element to your defense and really allow for you to get consistent pressure without having to blitz all the time, that's certainly a game changer. The Patriots were bottom third of the league in terms of sacks, despite being top 10, I think, in terms of total points allowed, which is a disparity that you don't often see, especially for teams that had as much success as they did. But I think this whole conversation starts and ends with the offensive line, personally. I would rank that number one, two, and three. And I would even say, kind of to that point, that it's an addition somewhere on this offensive line. And Ted Johnson landed on a guard that you can slide between Will Campbell and assumedly Jared Wilson, who you slide over to that center position. But it's also just answering the internal questions that you have in addition to adding something externally. It's, is Morgan Moses running it back for another year? Is he healthy enough? Does he have enough in him? And can he return to at least what was a better than league average level? Is Mike Onwenu's contract prohibitive to keeping him back to where you have to rethink things with him in order to sign Christian Gonzalez and also do your business this offseason? Is Garrett Bradbury back if Jared Wilson kicks over to center? And is Jared Wilson a starter at the NFL level right now? Did he prove enough as your left guard to where he earned it? For my money, you have five positions and five questions to where there is at least one question that you can ask about every single spot. And there were flashes of really, really good play from this group, especially the right side of the O-line, to where I think there is certainly less concern from the center position on down to the right. But I think that if you run it back with Will Campbell as your left tackle and Jared Wilson as your left guard and just leave that alone, then to me it kind of renders some of your other decisions in this offseason a bit moot. Because if Drake May is going to continue to be top five in the league in terms of sacks taken, and he's going to be running for his life against better pass rushes, just as a rule, then with the schedule that you're playing this upcoming year, in which you have just a bear, especially on the road, you're not going to be successful.
Nasty.
Yeah, and I want Will Campbell to be nasty. I love everything about him other than the performance on the field. Like, I love the personality. I love I will fight and die for my quarterback. I love the thing he said while he was still at LSU at his end of year presser, saying if you give up a sack a game, you're working at Amazon. The problem is he got way too close to that threshold and then beyond it in the playoffs to where it's just simply got to be better. I love that he's boys with Drake May. I think he's kind of a comfort blanket. They're both from the South. They both speak the same language, all that kind of stuff. But you can't do that while also being bad at your job. So, yeah, to me, that's really need one, two, and three. And I think a settled handful of questions on the offensive line opens up your offense more, and I think that allows you to then build off of that, add an edge rusher, do what you got to do on the defensive side of the football. But that is where I stood on that particular conversation, and we are out of time. So thank you, Tristan, back behind the glass. A lot of fun to work with you, my friend. First of hopefully many with the two of us here. That is it for us. Full slate of shows. That's right. It's Freebird takes us out. Full slate of shows tomorrow. Obviously, the weather is incoming, so stay safe out there. Stay warm. Don't strain your back trying to shovel the snow. Just be patient. Let it happen. And please, work as a team. Be neighbors with your neighbors. Be friends with your friends. And we'll all get through this one together, as it looks like it's going to be a doozy. Stay safe out there. Yes, Tristan?
Oh, yeah. Just don't be the guy that is shoveling your neighbors out of spite, like that one guy we heard about a couple weeks ago. Do it out of the kindness of your heart. Your neighbors will thank you.
Have a great rest of your Sunday. See ya.